This is Sound Ideas. I'm Mike McCurdy. Three new species of frog have been discovered high on a mountain in the Andes.
It's always very exciting to look for them. When you go to, as a biologist, you go to areas where nobody has been before, no scientist.
And it's not the first time Illinois Wesleyan University scientist Edgar Lehr has done that. Charlie Schlenker has the interview. The Ecology Action Center's Michael Brown is in the studio with an announcement about what would be the next McLean County Household Hazardous Waste Collection event this year. We'll talk about fundraising for the event and what people can drop off at these kinds of events. And during an edition of Grow, find out how to deal with an adorable but pesky garden visitor. That and a GLT News update on the way. It's August 3rd, 2017. This is Sound Ideas on GLT.
Support for the Sound Ideas podcast comes from listener contributions to GLT, with additional support from Country Financial Representative Justin M. Boyd. Information at justinmboyd.com. This is 89.1 GLT and WGLT.org.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Mike McCurdy. Fundraising is not quite finished, but going well, and the Ecology Action Center is announcing the details of the next Household Hazardous Waste Collection event in McLean County here on Sound Ideas. Michael Brown helps put the action in Ecology Action Center. He's the executive director. Michael, thanks for your time on Sound Ideas.
Thanks for having me.
So you've been working on this next HHW event since the last one in 2015. Before we talk about what might be the next one, let's touch on the last one really quickly. There was a 22% increase in the number of vehicles over 2013. That was down a little bit from the inaugural event. What about the amount of waste collected in 2015?
So we continue to see our volumes of waste increase as awareness grows. Essentially, this unique private-public partnership, how we're now funding these events, actually the entire campaign to raise money also acts as an awareness campaign. So awareness of the need to properly dispose of hazardous waste is at an all-time high for our community.
So is there a point where these kinds of events might be even less frequent than every 2 years? Do you think education about purchasing such items or the fact that you're collecting it regularly will lead to a decrease in the need to collect such items?
Yes and no. So big picture, you know, while awareness is at an all-time high and participation continues to increase in many ways, we're still fighting this massive machine of consumerism where so many goods are being created that contain hazardous materials. And so we're fighting some pretty significant forces there in trying to change behaviors here on our local level.
But every person that drops something off gets a touch. They get educated a little
Absolutely.
Bit about this. I mean, they're spending some time in the car, I assume you have an opportunity. I mean, they're captive, right?
Absolutely.
So you have an opportunity to say, hey, maybe next time you should buy this, you know, the 30-gallon jug of Absolutely. Roundup instead of the 50.
Right. So every car does receive information about some local programs to dispose of some things that can be locally any time of year. But as well, yes, we are trying to educate about alternatives, safer alternatives, programs like our Yard Smart program, which promotes less hazardous yard care solutions for a healthy but beautiful yard.
So I've used words like items. You've said the word waste. We're talking about anything that's toxic, corrosive, explosive, or reactive. What are some common examples in these categories?
So we're looking at things like oil-based paint. We're looking at things like fuel, like gas, oil, waste motor oil, cleaning oil, all those kind of things. We're looking at highly corrosive cleaners, you know, drain cleaner, things like that, pool chemicals. Just the list goes on and on. We're literally talking about thousands and thousands of different consumer goods. And so it's really even hard for us to put out a definitive list of what we can accept, so much as we put out, you know, some guidelines and then information on what we can't accept.
Is there enough consumer common sense here to know what you guys what the HHW will accept and what you won't?
There is. I think most people know what we're talking about. I think the biggest frustration comes when people do want to dispose of things like latex paint at these events. Latex paint is not easy to dispose of outside of a disposal option, but yet it is not hazardous. And so we don't take it at these events because it costs us about the same as it does for the hazardous oil-based paint.
And latex is pretty easy. You can just pour it out on a bunch of newspapers, let it dry, and wad it up and throw it away.
Exactly. It's safe and legal to put in the trash once it's dried out.
Electronics? TVs, old stereos, calculators,
absolutely.
Whatever.
Yeah. Home Sweet Home Ministries is our e-waste partner for this event, and so they will be there on-site taking these items. E-waste does contain some hazardous materials, and so, yes, we are happy to take that and usually take large volumes of those materials at this event.
Every time I see a TV at the side of the road, I just roll my eyes. It's like, come on.
Yeah.
And I see a lot of TVs. I mean, all those big tube TVs are sort of aging out right now, so I'm seeing a lot of those on the side of the road.
Exactly, but from our estimates from the waste industry, there's possibly as much as 10 years more of those still out there that we'll be dealing with this.
Another decade.
Yes.
Wow. This is Sound Ideas. I'm Mike McCurdy in the studio with Michael Brown. He's the executive director of the Ecology Action Center with some news about the next household hazardous waste collection in McLean County. Michael, what's the news?
So we've been fundraising for a few months now. We've got some big major partners on board. We've got Rivian Automotive willing to host us. We've got support, of course, from the local governments and big sponsors like Illinois Farm Bureau. We've got individual contributions ramping up every day. We have numerous checks come in. And so basically, fundraising is going so well. We're over halfway to our fundraising goal of $35,000. So we're calling this on. We're saying it's on. We're doing it. Saturday, September 9th, is the 2017 McLean County Household Hazardous Waste Collection event.
So you still have some fundraising to go. Most of those will be, at this point, the other 45% you need to raise will be individual contributions?
Yes. We've got, I think, all the big sponsors on board that we're probably getting for this time around. But yes, individual contributions in the past have, even day of the event, we pull in thousands of dollars of contributions right there on site. And so yes, we encourage people to continue to contribute to make this possible, because it really only is possible through this unique private public partnership. We're one of the very few communities in the entire state of Illinois that is actually properly still handling this issue in the absence of regular state collection events.
So where is the state? Where is the federal government in protecting the environment? Why is it up to the Ecology Action Center and local governments to foot the bill and stage these kinds of events?
Well, we all know there's some issues at the state level in the state of Illinois right now. And it's not just environmental. It's not just Illinois EPA. It is across the board. And so the state needs to really get its house in order and take care of things. And so we know right now in the interim that we cannot depend on the state. And so we are stepping up. However, we and others across the state and the nation are also looking at the bigger picture solutions. And so we know that while this is highly successful here in our community, where we're meeting the need better than most communities in Illinois, the bigger picture solution is really full life cycle solutions to these products. And so Ecology Action Center and many other organizations are part of the Illinois Product Stewardship Council, and also there's the National Product Stewardship Council. These are coalitions of manufacturers, retailers, waste industry professionals that we're working together to look at these needs. And so, for example, looking at oil-based paint, if we all up front understand that it has a bigger life cycle need than just us buying it, us using it, if we upfront are all willing to pay a little bit more in that purchase price as consumers, because this is the realistic, real cost of the product, then in the end of the system, ideally, we could have an easy, convenient disposal option, maybe right there back at the retailer.
Is oil-based paint even being manufactured anymore? I thought they were phasing it out.
It's being phased out. It's still available for some specific applications. And so that's maybe a poor example in that context, but people still have it.
Mm.
And so, but the point being, it's an obvious product that everyone's familiar with that is hazardous. But there's other examples. E-waste, which actually is a poor example right now in the state of Illinois. We've been trying to deal with this e-waste problem for several years. There's actually been multiple different variations on an e-waste law. There's actually a new one that's going into effect here in 2018 that hopefully will finally address the issue properly. I mean, we have in McLean County been lucky to have good e-waste collection points that take most e-waste materials from residents, but yet most communities in Illinois are not so lucky. So there's a lot of smaller communities, smaller counties that don't have anything at all, or they may take some basic things but not take expensive things like CRT, tube-style televisions. So we need a better comprehensive solution. This has been an ongoing process. Waste professionals, municipalities, counties, retailers, manufacturers working together for years, and I think we are finally getting close to the real solution.
So you mentioned this is a public-private partnership. You mentioned some of the private entities involved. Let's talk more about the public, because the private dollars being raised from individuals, that's just part of the money that's going into this. McLean County, City of Bloomington, Town of Normal are also bankrolling this. Well, what is their contribution?
So we have $140,000 from those public entities that they've contributed over, you know, these past 2 years, essentially. So saving up for this year's event. And so we have that is kind of the base funding. But we know that these events can cost $150,000, $160,000, $170,000 or more dollars for this one-day event. And so that's why the private funding comes in as well, the fundraising to supplement that public funding.
And you had a bit of a bank going into the fundraising campaign. Why is that important to have a bit of a buffer there?
So, yeah. So last time, 2015, was so successful, we did have residual funding. We had about $32,000 left over, which is, you know, dedicated restricted funding just for hazardous waste, actually by law, when donations are donated that way. So that is the reserve now, because even though our best estimates of traffic, of materials and such show that we should be able to pay for this year's event with a budget of about $170,000, $175,000, we don't know what year that it's going to happen, that we go well over budget, that turnout is much better than anticipated, that materials that are brought are more expensive than usual, all these other variables that we don't have control over, which actually, that would be a good problem. It'd be good to have an event that's so successful that we actually have to dip into these reserves.
You don't actually know how much it's going to cost until you get the bill.
Exactly. We have no idea.
Who's the contractor? Who's taking this stuff?
So we've hired Tredebi, which is a hazardous waste company. They're actually international. We've just hired them as of yesterday for this year's event. They actually have done our past two locally funded events as well. Very good company to work with.
And what do they actually do? On site and then later.
Sure. And so on site, they're the ones that are taking the material out of people's cars. They're first identifying materials. Some things come unlabeled or unidentified. And so some things they have to use an on site lab to actually determine what the heck this is so that they know how to handle it safely, because that right there could create a crisis very quickly if something's handled.
Right. You don't want to mix. I mean, you don't want to start your own chemical chain reaction
at
the parking lot there where you're collecting it.
So identifying, bulking things up. And so they bring a whole, I don't know how many hundreds of 55-gallon drums, things that can be bulked up, whether it's, you know, all the oil-based paint or all the used motor oil, those things are bulked up. The containers are actually thrown out. Those are harmless. And then, yeah, everything's transported to appropriate facilities. Some things can be recycled. Some things can be made into energy, like that waste fuel oil is used as an energy source. And other oil-based things sometimes can as well. Some things can be recycled, talking about like the mercury that we find in CFL lamps, fluorescent tubes, lead that is found in electronics, and so on and so forth. So some things can be recycled, but that is kind of a minority amongst these things. Some things need to be stabilized and then are put into a hazardous waste landfill, essentially for perpetuity, which needs to be very closely monitored, has extra systems for that monitoring in contrast to a regular solid waste landfill. Some things are so unstable that actually they are incinerated, is deemed the safest way to dispose of them because they're not even safe in that hazardous waste landfill.
Can you recall an example of an unlabeled item that had to be tested and what it turned out to be?
I cannot, because that is actually, that's above my pay grade.
You just run the other way.
Exactly. So I don't handle any materials at the entire event, neither do any of our volunteers or our people. That is what the professional chemists from Trudevi handle.
Speaking of volunteers, still looking for some?
We are definitely looking for volunteers. And actually, we have not even opened that process yet. We will be, now that we do have a event date, we'll be opening that up probably in the next week. We need actually hundreds of volunteers to run this event smoothly. So yes, we do encourage people to go to our website. We have a shortcut URL, hhwmclean.org, where people can learn about the event. They can make a donation, and they will be able to sign up to volunteer.
Not only community volunteers, a lot of community organizations. You talked about some of them. It's a real community effort. There's even a T-shirt. So if there's a T-shirt, you know it's a thing, right?
Absolutely.
And on the reverse are all of the organizations making it possible. You mentioned Rivian. How are they to work with?
Rivian has been incredible. Rivian is so enthusiastic about being a positive part of this community, contributing, and really making a difference that, yes, yeah, since we first reached out, when they first came on the scene. They've been receptive all along and just, yes, very eager to make this event a success.
And should people now be going through their, you know, garage, their shed, their basement, under the sink, and looking at some of this stuff and going, oh my God, I'm never going to use this. I need to get rid of it. Should they be sort of starting to think about and collect some of this stuff now?
Absolutely. Collecting, sorting through it, starting to kind of organize it together, but as well working with one's neighbors. And so this is something that we always try and encourage, is carpooling your hazardous waste. All right. So it's going to be faster, easier, more efficient for everybody if we have more waste coming in fewer vehicles. And so specifically those of you who have a truck, a van, a vehicle that can hold a little more stuff, organize, please, with your neighbors. Bring their stuff if you're going anyway. We can save gas. We can save time. We can make it easier for everybody that way, especially looking at our neighbors, perhaps who are elderly or not able to get out, really provide assistance to them would be very helpful.
If I recall, 1,600 vehicles in 2015.
Yes.
So ideally, you'd like to see the amount collected go up and the number of vehicles go down.
Exactly. That ratio of essentially households served per vehicle, we want to see that increase.
Any real progress being made on product stewardship? You mentioned this. And do you think events like this at all enable consumers to continue to buy the big gulp-sized container of herbicide and then just go, well, I'll just drop it off at the HHW event?
Yes and no. I mean, there's definitely, it can be argued both ways. We don't want to enable people by making it too easy and therefore encourage people to buy wasteful quantities of materials. But at the same time, right now, the need exists. And so we need to meet that need while looking bigger picture at the long term and trying to change behaviors, buying behaviors, even, yes, what are we buying? Can we buy safer alternatives? And so going that direction long term is definitely the answer.
Okay, Michael, thanks for your time on Sound Ideas. Again, the details of the event one more time, 8 a.m. to 2 p.m. on Saturday, September 9th.
Correct. At Rivian Automotive, south entrance. And so this is new. We're coming in on the south side off of West College Avenue near Mitsubishi Motorway. So not the west side. Watch for signage. It should be obvious.
And that's, of course, the former Mitsubishi Motor Manufacturing Plant.
That is correct.
Find more information on donating and other links at our website, WGLT.org. Michael, thanks for your time.
Thank you.
This is Sound Ideas.
Support for GLT comes from Westminster Village, helping individuals stay healthy and active in retirement through a variety of social and well-being activities, wellness programs, and on-site therapy services available. 2025 East Lincoln Street in Bloomington. This is 89.1 GLT and WGLT.org.
It's Sound Ideas. I'm Mike McCurdy. Prairie Fire Theater is staging a classic musical that has a plot that's future-forward. Laura Kennedy has more.
Originally written in 1956, The Most Happy Fella has a modern slant on its love story, with an element of catfishing between the leads, one of whom is played by Prairie Fire Theater's own Bob Mangiolardi. Written by Frank Lesser, some say The Most Happy Fella is a musical, while others define it as an opera. Director Emily Hansel says it's actually the closest a musical can be to being an opera.
It is definitely a musical. It's got a great combination of its music, its dialogue. So an opera is through sung, and this is not through sung.
Maybe we could call it an operacle.
An operacle. I love that. It's an operacle, which I think is a great way of encapsulating the strangeness of this. It's so weird because you have numbers that come across as they could be right out of Guys and Dolls, which Frank Lesser actually wrote directly before this, I believe. So they sound like there are these really fun musical theater numbers.
Standing on the corner, watching all the girls go by. Standing on the corner, watching all the girls go by. Brother, you don't know a nicer occupation. Matter of fact, neither do I. Then standing on the corner, watching all the girls, watching all the girls, watching all the girls go by.
And everyone in the cast is dancing and singing and, you know, spinning around. And then you go to another number. We have this beautiful quartet, How Beautiful the Days. It sounds like it could be straight from a Puccini opera.
How beautiful the days, they come and go.
So it's a very quick turnaround, but it's really interesting, and it keeps the audience and us on our toes.
In most musicals, there's several pages of dialogue. You'll see, you know, there's a book, and you'll have three, four, five, six pages of dialogue before a song starts. The longest duration of dialogue is only one page. Mm-hmm. So there is more music. In that sense, it is leaning towards opera in that there's not as much dialogue. There is dialogue, but it tends to be much more sporadic. And like I said, maybe there's two or three sections where there's only one page. It never goes more than one page. So that's, mm-hmm. for a musical, that's pretty unusual.
Bob, why did Prairie Fire Theater want to stage this show?
Okay, well, that's a good question. We have a committee on my board, and we kind of sat around and we picked five shows that we thought could fit us and be interested in. And, you know, one of our biggest criteria is that we want to pick things that demand really good singing. We've tried really hard to have an orchestra with each show, and we always have live musicians, professional musicians. A lot of places are going with just a CD and kind of canned music, and that's fine, and I totally understand why they would do that, because it's very expensive to have a good orchestra, or they just can't find players, you know.
So how big is your orchestra?
We'll have 15 players,
okay.
Which is really pretty big. I mean, other than universities that have students that can play for free, get credits, we're one of the only groups around that's using a big orchestra. So anyway, we wanted something that was demanding vocally. We've done some operas, we've done some operettas, we've obviously done lots of musicals, and so there were just a lot of great parts. There's a lot of good character parts. So six or seven, of maybe even eight of the characters have significant solos or longer pieces. So I was attracted to it. And that, I like the story.
Tell us about the story.
I kind of like to think of it as one of the original catfishing stories.
That's exactly what I was going to say. It's like it could have been written for the internet age.
Yeah. It could be a reality TV show, which actually was something we talked about as potentially a concept for, but we decided to keep it in the period in which it was written or very close to. The concept is that Tony, who is played by Bob here, he sees a waitress in a restaurant in Frisco, and he leaves her a note and an amethyst tie pin and says he would love to start up an email. Oh, my goodness. I'm
there you
really
go.
Living in the 21st century. He sends her a letter and asks her to write him back. And so they begin this romance via letter. She sends herself a picture of him and asks for a picture in return. But he realizes that if he sends his picture, he doesn't believe that she will come to Napa to marry him.
Because Tony's an older guy.
He's an older guy.
And she's younger.
It's written in the score that he's unattractive, but Bob is not.
No.
So it's a little off book there. So he sends a picture of a much younger man, his foreman, actually, whose name is Joe, who plays a significant part in the drama. So with that knowledge, she comes to Napa as what she refers to a mail-order bride. But, and then when she finds out that Tony was not the man he presented himself to be. Things kind of develop from there. I don't want to spoil the ending. But...
Bob, tell us about Tony. This is a little misleading by sending a photo of somebody else to represent himself to this gal.
Yeah.
Tell us about this guy.
He just wants to be married, and he's a successful businessman. He has a very, very successful vineyard in California. He's in his, you know, late 50s, early 60s, and he just decides that he wants to get married, and he's going to resort to some more desperate measures here. He's fun-loving.
Hey, I'm the most happy fella in the whole Napa Valley. In the whole Napa Valley, the most happy man, that's me. Look at my Rosabella.
He's the most happy fella.
Look at my Rosabella.
Look at his Rosabella.
She was sending me her photograph. And she was asking me for mine.
But it does turn out that he really falls in love with her. I mean, obviously he's attracted to her at first, and it's just a picture thing. As the show goes on, he really does seem to fall in love with her. And I think her with him. It's not just convenient, and it's not just physical.
They make a connection.
Exactly, yeah. Mm-hmm. And so I like that about it, too. Tony really is a tour de force part, which I hope I can do.
He sounds great. They all sound great. I'm overwhelmed by how wonderful they are.
We don't see as many revivals of The Most Happy Fella these days. Is it because it's such a demanding show vocally?
There have been a couple of revivals. So it was revived on Broadway in 92, and that was that main revival. There's a version that I've seen. It's on YouTube. It's by what's called the DiCapo Opera Group. And then in 2014, the New York City Opera did a revival with starring Laura Benanti, who is a favorite musical performer of mine. So it has had some recurrence recently. And I think, from my understanding, a lot of opera companies like doing it as kind of more of an outreach. Opera companies have, as of late, been including one or two musicals in their season as a way to draw on audiences and to expand their reach. And this is one that's favored for them.
So it's like a gateway opera.
It's a gateway opera.
right. But it's a hybrid. Unusual form. I mean, it's not really like Les Mis, but again, Les Mis, is it an opera? Is it a musical? Mm-hmm. Sweeney Todd, is that an opera? Is it a musical?
You know, but we don't even seem all that concerned anymore about these labels in entertainment.
No. Well, again, what our strengths are as a group, we've been lucky to have really talented singers. And so if you come to a Prairie Fire Theater show, you're going to hear some really, I hope, extraordinary voices, and we'll tell a great story. You know, we're in Westbrook, which is a very great place to sing, but technically it's not like other places. We can't quite do the technical stuff we can do in other places. So we just decide to put our eggs in that basket, which is get the best singers we can get, always have good directors and good conductors, and have a really fine orchestra. And if you want to hear a great evening of that, then you should come hear our show.
That's Bob Mangiolardi and Emily Hansel. The Most Happy Fella, presented by Prairie Fire Theater, opens tomorrow night and runs through August 6th in Westbrook Auditorium in Bloomington. I'm Laura Kennedy.
When A Most Happy Fella originally was staged on Broadway in the 1950s, part of it was actually featured in an episode of I Love Lucy. The episode entitled Lucy's Night in Town featured the Ricardo and Mertz families attending the show in New York. This was no random selection. Lucille Ball and Desi Arnaz were two of the original investors in A Most Happy Fella. You're listening to the overture from the original Broadway soundtrack to A Most Happy Fella on Sound Ideas. Sound Ideas. I'm Mike McCurdy. Coming up, help with an adorable but pesky garden pest, and it's an edition of Grow coming up during Sound Ideas. Illinois Wesleyan University biologist Edgar Lehr has done it again. He and a colleague have found and described three new species of frogs in the high Andes Mountains. The latest are the Puipui rubber frog, the Hill Dweller rubber frog, and Humboldt's rubber frog. All three are found between 10 and 12,000 feet on a mountain in Peru. Earlier this year, Lair also published a paper describing Attenborough's rubber frog, and WGLT's Charlie Schlenker talked with the biologist about that discovery. Attenborough's rubber frog is of the same genus as the last three frogs. They breed on dry land, unlike many frog species which reproduce in water. This interview from March is helpful in understanding Lair's latest discoveries.
It's always very exciting to look for them. When you go to, as a biologist, you go to areas where nobody has been before, no scientist, and you're looking for amphibians and reptiles and anything you find there can potentially be new, yeah? As it was during my last expeditions to Peru.
You've named this one Attenborough's rubber frog. Why?
Why does somebody not want to name a species after Sir David Attenborough? It's such a fascinating and admirable person. He has done so much for biology. The movies that are well known among the population, among students. I frequently use his movies in class. And he has done very good movies about frogs and pointed out their critical situation in the world. I saw his interview when he turned 90 years old, I was wondering, I should name a frog after him. Then I was looking into databases and realized that not a single amphibian species has been named after Attenborough. And I thought with my colleague, we should change this.
That's a little bit of an oversight, considering that he likes amphibians.
So. Yeah, exactly. So I was expecting that there are maybe others named species after him, but not there. Of course, I think 16 species that have been named after him, and now 17 with this frog added.
What did he say when you asked him?
He was thrilled. I sent a letter to him asking him for permission, what one normally should do when dedicating a species after a living person, yeah, to ask for permission, because you don't want to insult a person. Yeah? Imagine somebody has a phobia against frogs and you name a frog after this person. It would not be good, obviously.
Not
yeah?
good, no.
I introduced shortly myself to him and my colleague, a photo of the frog where we discovered it and asking for the permission to name it. And we gave the name, how it would be called to him. And now a little bit more than a week, I got a letter back from him with a personal note saying that he's thrilled and he likes the idea, gave us permission to do so.
Yeah. Why rubber frog?
I have actually no idea, but this is the common popular term for this genus. I have no idea who came up with this name rubber.
Let's talk about the frog itself. What does it look like, and how did you know right away that it was different?
Definitely. I have a lot of experience in the high elevation, the Andes, working in Peru. So I have an idea how the known species look. Yeah, and this was something where nobody has been before, and it looked totally different. Yeah, so it was immediately clear that we have found a new species.
What you may consider totally different and what I or any other layperson may consider totally different could be different things. Yeah. What do you mean?
For me, it's like the experience, it's like the size, a combination of characters such as the size, about 2 centimeters long, then the coloration, dark brown, greenish, gray, and where it lived. Yeah, very, very isolated area. Yeah, so it was clear.
I was struggling through the paper, and there was a description of supratympanic striping that was also distinctive. I'm guessing that has something to do with stripes over its ear pits.
Exactly. These are kind of standard terminology. I agree with you that reading such papers is not very entertaining. Yeah, these are working papers that one needs when he describes other species here to compare it with. But these are kind of standard characters, and the format is standard that is used by scientists for the purpose in describing frogs.
What makes it different from other similar types of genuses or species?
Genus is more difficult. Actually, we thought when we found it that it would belong to a different genus that also is restricted in northern and central Peru at high elevations, and had all the character, morphological character combinations with the Andes frogs. Yeah? And so then we were surprised when my colleague, Dr. Von May at the University of Michigan, conducted a genetic research, a phylogeny, an evolutionary tree, and it was revealed in this tree that this frog is actually part of a different genus. Yeah.
Which one?
Pristimantis, yeah, where we kind of placed it in then. Yeah? So you can see how different sets of characters are important to diagnose and identify a species.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. We're talking with Edgar Lehr, a biologist at Illinois Wesleyan University who has discovered a new frog in the high Andes of Peru. When you found out that it was of a different genus than you thought it might be, does that suggest anything about the genus that you thought it might be in the first place?
Exactly. So we commented on that researchers have to be very careful by just using morphological character combinations because it can be totally misleading. Yeah, this is a sign that different character combinations have evolved convergently, yeah, without reflecting relationships in the Andes among frogs. Yeah, now we are looking into the genus where we wanted to place this frog at the beginning to see if there are other frogs that maybe are misplaced in this genus, and we have so far have found one potential candidate to which this frog that we described is very similar to. Yeah.
But if it's not misplaced and there is convergent evolution, yeah, what does that say about the Andes that produces these yeah kinds of characteristics, whether yeah it's the webbing on the toes or the way the head looks or the jaw looks or the ear locations look like?
Exactly. This is another very interesting research topic to look how an environment kind of shapes an organism that lives in this. Yeah, we cannot only see this within the Andes of Peru. There are similar cases in the mountains of Philippines or the Himalayas that the factors of environment, climatic conditions, kind of shape the morphology of organisms that then appear to look similar without being related to each other.
So what about the Andes produces this?
Oh, the Andes are known to be a hot spot for biodiversity. It's 20 years that I do research in Peru, and it never gets boring. I mean, you have to go to an isolated area, and you will, if you do a good job, if you're committed to field work, yeah, then you can find organisms, yeah, reptiles, amphibians that nobody before you has discovered.
You had to get there by horseback. How isolated is it?
It is very much isolated. In 2012, I got a grant from National Geographic especially for this protected area, Puy Puy Protected Forest, which was established, I think, in the mid-80s. But there are no reports. Nobody knows what is living there. Yeah, and I thought, why is that? Yeah, so I got the grant and the money to go there. Then I realized why nobody went there before me, because it's so difficult to get access to it. Yeah, it's practically a rectangular, artificially shaped area in the center of the eastern Andes. Yeah, so it takes like going by car to the next villages are usually in two walking distances from the entrance of the protected area. Yeah, so a combination of cars asking locals with their horses to help you, then you have to walk, not too much fun at very high elevations, through rough terrain.
Frogs are usually considered low-level rainforest types of things, but that obviously is not the case. How high up do they go, and what is the climate?
In Peru, the record is close to the snow border.
Wow.
Yeah? So close to 5,000 meters.
Pretty interesting for something without much of an internal temperature control.
Exactly. So they are in the challenge, but at this high elevation, the temperature changes are very drastically. So in the daytime, you can have summer temperatures, yeah, and in the night, winter. Yeah. So they have to deal with these drastic changes, and they manage to do so.
How do they do that? I mean, what sort of biochemistry allows them to take the huge fluctuations?
Well, I can comment on their behavior. What they would, for example, do when it gets cold, they would simply hide under stones, and the stone layers there can store the heat. Yeah. So it's actually when you look under stones, often it's not that cold under. Yeah. So they can select temperature level they are comfortable in. When it gets warm, then they can get closer to the sun.
What's their food and what are their predators?
Food are arthropods, such as insects, for example, spiders, whatever fits usually in a mouth of a small frog.
And their predators?
Predators, for this it hasn't been studied, but there can be snakes. Yeah, of course, snakes do not get reach such high elevations, but at slightly lower there are snakes. It can be birds that feed on them, or large spiders, for example. Yeah.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. We're talking with Edgar Lehr about a new frog. He's from Illinois Wesleyan University. Do we know how many of these there are? Are there likely to be? And what their range is?
So we found this new species inside and outside the protected area, I think in total from 9 different places that we have mapped. And we do not know how far more this distribution goes into the protected area or out of the other border of this protected area. It's unknown, but usually amphibians from high elevations have a relatively small distributional area simply because of the borders that can be other mountains or deep valleys. Yeah, so usually they have very restricted, more restricted distributional areas the higher one is in the Andes.
Why is it important for us to keep knowing these things, to keep reaching out for the micro differences in taxonomy that we're looking at?
Yeah, amphibians are often termed like the canaries of the coal mines because they respond very sensitively towards changes in our environment. And when we see amphibians disappearing, and this is something that happens worldwide now, it's very scary, and we should be very much alarmed as humans to change then something, to kind of prevent them from dying out. And this has been observed even in protected areas that amphibians are dying. We only can protect what we actually know. Yeah? And the more we know, the better we can protect it.
Yeah. We've heard about, in the popular media, we've heard about those amphibian die-offs, but we also heard about parthenogenic development of amphibians, too. Were there odd sex-linked traits that you noticed at this altitude in these populations?
There's nothing known from high elevations that are one has observed, like malformations within frogs, nothing known.
When are you going back?
I go back actually next Monday. Yeah, it was a spontaneous idea because I'm on a sabbatical. Now I'm kind of flexible to travel and to do research. And I thought, I want to go back to Peru, so I go next week for 2 weeks.
What are you looking for then?
I will go to Lima to the Natural History Museum. My collaborators there for since nearly 20 years, and I will revise specimens in the collection. I will meet several colleagues and friends and work with new species.
Congratulations.
Thank you so much.
I'm Charlie Schlenker. We've been talking with Edgar Lehr of Illinois Wesleyan University. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Most of the frogs were discovered by searching through moss and grass and other vegetation. In some cases, the researchers found the frogs after hearing the males calling during light afternoon or evening rains. The Pui Pui Protected Forest covers 150,000 acres. You're listening to Sound Ideas.
Support for GLT's Sound Ideas comes from Country Financial Representative Justin M. Boyd, helping investors plan for the future and stay on track for retirement and college savings based on their unique situations and goals. Details at justinmboyd.com. This is 89.1 GLT and WGLT.org.
I'm Mike McCurdy. Sometimes the problems in our gardens creep in on four legs and are frankly adorable. Patrick Murphy, host of GLT's Grow, has advice on dealing with cute critters with not so cute habits.
We share our yard with a host of hungry critters that can inflict damage when sitting down to dine. I'm Laura Kennedy, and this is GLT's Grow, your source for practical gardening advice from our experts in the field. From the Illinois State University School of Biological Sciences and curator of the Fell Arboretum, it's Patrick Murphy. Hey, Murph.
Good day, Laura.
Today on GLT's Grow, we have two questions about dealing with deterring wild animals in our yards. And the first one comes from Lori in Lexington, Illinois. She says, is there any organic way to deter raccoons and chipmunks?
Okay.
Okay. So, and we're organic. Mm-hmm. So we're focusing on that. We don't want to hurt any animals here on GLT's Grow.
Right. So we cannot talk about toxicants, because toxicants are one way to eliminate rodents and ground critters, and that's not the scenario we're looking for here.
Uh-huh.
You don't need any special permission to deal with rodents, but with the raccoons and the chipmunks and things like that, handling them organically usually means discouraging them from having a habitat, you know, managing their habitat to discourage them from setting up camp there.
Uh-huh.
And the most organic way is to trap them in a live trap and redeposit them elsewhere.
And that's best left to the professionals,
and
isn't
it requires a license.
Yes.
It is something that you can hire professionally. They have to have a license, and you do too.
Oh, really?
So if you go to the garage sale and somebody sells you the live trap, because I see them for sale at garage sales all the time.
That's right, because you go to Farm and Fleet, you buy one, you trap something, and then, well, what are you going to do with it? Let the kids play with it?
Yeah,
no.
I know. That's a great point, Laura, because what you cannot do is take it down the street to the local park or forest preserve and release it.
Mm-hmm.
You need to release it on private property, and if it's not yours, you should have permission to release it.
So make sure that you're dealing with this legally and get your license and get a professional to deal with it. But, you know, I have to wonder, if they're setting up shop in your yard, could you just eliminate their food sources so they decide maybe this isn't such a plush place to live?
That's one half of it, mm-hmm. is to eliminate their food and water sources. So if you're feeding the birds and you have a bird feeder out, make no mistake, when the raccoons show up for work after you've gone to bed, it's resort city in that bird bath. And mm-hmm. it's like, wow, those birds are eating a lot of seed. Well, it's the raccoon dumping it all out on the ground so he and his friends, or she and their friends, mm-hmm. can just chow down. And who could blame him? Bird seed looks and sounds so delicious.
Right.
So the habitat modification is a good way to go. It can also involve things like eliminating their access. So if they're getting into your garden shed, patch that hole. If they're digging under the fence to get into your cat corral, I've seen landscapes where they have these little wired gravel floor areas for the kitty cats to play.
Uh-huh.
The coons will go right underneath of it.
Mm-hmm.
And so will other animals, the little ground squirrels and chipmunks both, because they're two separate animals. So there's some work required in doing that. So, you know, guards, barriers, and screens that reduce the access to their habitat. And scarecrows and frightening devices are helpful for raccoons, too.
Put a clown in your backyard.
Oh, yeah. If you don't want me to come over, that'll work, too. Yeah. But we started off talking about, you know, what's legal. The Illinois Department of Natural Resources is who you would want to contact, one, to get the permit, but also to talk to somebody to give you an understanding of what to do.
Mm-hmm.
You could also seek that kind of advice and get it quickly in a timely manner from Extension, from your local county Extension office. The varmints aren't protected by the Migratory Bird Treaty Act.
Yeah, they're not geese.
But it is something that falls under the U.S. Fish and Wildlife's reach.
Mm-hmm.
And
so obey the law.
Yeah, there's laws involved. So it's less critical with the varmints, but more important with the birds.
Okay. You're listening to GLT's Grow, our weekly gardening show for those who like to get their hands dirty, this week humanely dealing with critters. And we have another question about critters. This is from Samina in Bloomington. She says that she has a full sun walkway leading up to her house where she's planted many different full sun low flowering perennials. And nothing survives the appetite of the unwanted resident rabbits. So mm-hmm. she needs some help here because these flowers are the focal point of her entrance, and she's tired of being, you know, the bunny buffet.
Understood. That's really frustrating. And, you know, they're such cute little creatures, but
They're hungry.
How quickly they lose their cuteness.
They're like hungry hippos.
So there's a couple of store-bought products. One is called Ropel. And it has tobacco residue and pepper residue in it. And
it won't harm your plants.
It won't harm the plants or your pets. Your mm-hmm. pets won't like it, but it won't harm them.
Mm-hmm.
So if it were to wash off onto a little puddle in the ground and kitty cat took a drink, it's just going to get a little spicy taste in the mouth.
Mm-hmm.
No harm. This stuff works, but its persistency is short. So when it's really hot and dry like it is here in the Midwest, you might have to reapply it every 2 or 3 days because the hot sun is going to make it break down quickly. And it's for sure going to wash away if it's cool and mild enough in the mornings that there's dew That'll reduce its effectiveness. So you're respraying it a lot during the springtime.
So get a big bottle.
Yeah, you're going to need a lot of it. But knowing that, you could also make your own pepper spray, and you get some jalapeno peppers and a big bucket of, you know, a couple, 2 to 5 gallons of water, and you make a tea, essentially, out of the peppers and the water, and then you can spray that just like you would the Ropel. The persistency thing is still an issue.
All right.
It'll break down quickly. But this stuff works. You just have to stick with it. And, you know, because rabbits are all about multiplying, you can scare off the ones that are there before Mother's Day and think your problem is done. And then before Father's Day rolls around, there's little rabbits right back in the
same
spot.
Next generation.
The next generation is waiting for the Ropel or the pepper tea to wash off. There are other dusts that have the same compounds in them that you can get at Farmer Service or a reputable garden center.
But again, this is stuff that doesn't harm the animal. It deters the animal.
It deters them, and it makes what they're dining on less palatable. That's how it works.
Mm-hmm. What about planting something that isn't very appealing to rabbits? Is there such a thing?
My personal opinion is there's not such a thing. Because I landscaped off of the deer friendly list in part of my career when I worked in the Chicagoland market, only to see the deer not pay attention to that list.
Didn't they get the memo?
I know. Well, they don't return any emails or phone calls.
Oh, they're so vexing.
So that, I just think you have to manage your expectations.
Mm-hmm.
If that existed, it would be available. You could go to the rabbit free section at the garden center and not have to worry about it. And that doesn't exist.
And those companies would not be able to stay in business because it would work so well that, you know, pretty soon you just wouldn't have to worry about it anymore.
And I think when it comes to the rabbits and the groundhogs and the ground squirrels, different than the, you know, red-tailed squirrel or a fox squirrel or a gray squirrel, the rabbits and the ground squirrels and chipmunks, they seem to be more intimidated by the scaring devices.
Oh, like what's a good one?
A scarecrow.
A scarecrow?
Well, you know,
what about lights?
I just think this is an interesting story, but not scientific. I know
somebody
that had the problem with the squirrels, but they noticed when the Halloween thing that screamed when you walked up to the front door was there.
The rabbits ran off?
The rabbits beat it. The rabbits were scared of it.
Oh, well, that's interesting.
So that was like an audible noise. Mm-hmm. The Corn Belt Library System used to have a device that you could check out, and it had these chirps that were outside of our hearing, but grackles and blackbirds and rabbits and possums, they could hear it, and it would scare them away.
So something audible might be a really good alternative for Samina.
Yes.
Thank you so much for your question, Samina. And also to you, Lori, good luck with your critter problems. And again, as we say, first, do no harm. Do not harm the critters. And always make sure you're doing things the grow way. Now, next week on GLT's Grow, Ron in Morton is concerned about his white pine trees. He wants to keep them free of disease. We'd like to hear from you and get your gardening questions. Go to our website and submit those now at wglt.org/grow.
You can download the Grow podcast weekly at iTunes or at our website, wglt.org. Our website is also where you can find the full Sound Ideas podcast, along with the individual stories and interviews today. Thanks to Laura Kennedy and Charlie Schlenker. Also, thanks to Michael Brown from the Ecology Action Center for his announcement about the 2017 Household Hazardous Waste Collection event. We want to know what you think of Sound Ideas. Post at facebook.com/WGLTFM or tweet, use the hashtag Sound Ideas. I'm at Mike McCurdy. We're all at WGLT News. Thanks for choosing Sound Ideas on WGLT Normal and WGLT.org. Bloomington Normal's public media.